All right, here we go. Podcast begins. Explorer Albert. And this is episode number one.
Welcome to Explorer Albert.
Okay, for real.
What does it feel like to be the first one inside an ancient tomb that hasn't been opened for 1,000 years? What does it feel like to be the first cohort of archaeologists to bring LIDAR into the jungles of Guatemala and then find 60,000 new Maya structures in a single year? Well, we're about to talk to somebody who did just that. My good friend and archaeology pioneer, Dr. Tom Garrison. Ready? Let's go.
At that moment of near disaster,
and with difficulty kept my course.
Of chimpanzees in the wild.
It was for us the pleasure of discovering.
Tom and I go way back. We go back to the earliest days of my career as an explorer for National Geographic. It was actually right after my very first project, where I was running around the fields of Mongolia, northern Mongolia, that I actually got to meet Tom. But it was way before that, back even to before I became a National Geographic explorer, that I had been reading about Tom. There's something I wanted to try to bring here to this podcast, is that a single image can shape everything and can change your life. That's happened to me over and over and over again. And in a lot of ways, Tom, who's on the other end of this call, he represented that for me at a critical moment when I was sitting in my little grad school office feeling a bit, disheartened by the grind of trying to create some kind of scientific outcome that was meaningful as a graduate student in material science. And I read this article. It was an article that described a group of Mayanists and graduate students of archaeology that were running through the jungles of Guatemala with a map that they had created with satellite imagery to look for ancient ruins. This is back in 2008, maybe 2009?
No, we were doing that 2003 to 2005, yeah.
Okay, yeah. 2003 to 2005. That article, that image in my mind of graduate students running through the jungle with machetes, looking for ancient Mayan ruins, using satellites from space, that were looking for, at the time they had figured out that the limestone in the pyramids of the ancient Maya would leach sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, into the trees that were growing above the Maya forest, and you could actually see it. Is that, what have we got here, Baird? You got NASA and archaeology from space. Okay, so do you recognize anybody in that spread there, Tom?
Yeah, sure. Tom Seaver, who was a great mentor to me and really, got me into all of this remote sensing. And, he's a guy who has this amazing career, and he's the one that has said all along that remote sensing, one day is going to be the key to helping us really understand the ancient Maya. And so, there's another photo there where he was holding a GPS and talking to another guy, and that was Dan Irwin. And he was also at Marshall Space and Flight. And those two guys would come down to San Bartolo, and they would have these, very fancy poster-size 3D or poster-size laminated printouts with, grid coordinates on it. And then, we would have a GPS, and we would go out and we would wander and we would go to these places. Yeah, that's Tom and Dan right there. And we would try to see if we could find Maya ruins. And at that particular place and time, all of the variables kind of came together so that it was this very successful use of this technology.
So you published a couple papers there, right, as a graduate student?
Yeah, well, it was, we did do a couple of of articles, you know, with Tom and with Dan and with the project director, Bill Saturno. And then, you know, my sort of piece of that puzzle was then after we found all the big sites, you know, could we use it to find smaller Maya ruins? Because we knew there was stuff between these sites just from walking around. And so that ended up being a big part of my doctoral dissertation work. And, you know, it was after grad school when I went to go work in another part of the Maya area, closer to the great city of Tikal, that we found out that, you know, it wasn't the silver bullet. It wasn't working everywhere.
Well, I mean, you know, technology never is, except for, in some ways, there has been a breakthrough. And that breakthrough is something that I've been very lucky to be there with you to be able to witness and help share the stories of and be on the ground for. And also how we met was experimenting with and developing tools of LIDAR. Okay, the famous LIDAR. Okay, let's just break this down, because our shows, you know, they kind of go through it really quickly. But Tom Garrison, you're a good friend of mine, a professor of geography and an archaeologist who specializes in LIDAR. Now you run, I think it's called the Llama Lab at UT in Austin. Is that right? What does Llama stand for?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm the child of an advertiser, so it was very important for me to brand my lab when I got here. But it's LIDAR and Landscapes of the Ancient Mediterranean and Americas. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Are there llamas in the Mediterranean? I don't know, man. That might be not.
No, but, you know, they're not llamas in the Maya area either, but you know, it gives us a good mascot, and it certainly rolls off the tongue better.
Okay,
but, you know,
Tom Garrison, Llama Lab.
You said that you know how an image can sort of change your life or reorient you, and my experience with LIDAR, you know, already having all this experience with using satellite imagery and stuff like that, was in 2010. I was living in northern Sweden. I had a postdoc at Umeå University in a digital humanities lab up there, and it was very close to the Arctic Circle, and it was freezing, and there was a conference. The European Maya Conference was happening in Madrid in December. And I said, I got to get out of here because the sun hadn't shone in like 2 months. And so I go down to this conference in Madrid, and this guy, Arlen Chase, showed me the first image of LIDAR in the Maya area that I'd seen from his groundbreaking work in Belize. He's really the guy that got us to where we are now. And he showed me this series of slides where it was this 3D view of the trees over his site that he directs, Caracol. And then the next one, the trees just come off and you see everything underneath. And, you know, by everything, I don't mean just like the pyramids. I mean, you know, every little terrace where they practice agriculture, every little road and footpath leading out of the site. And I said, this is what people have been looking for with remote sensing. And, you know, that's kind of how I met you, Albert, because after that, everything that I did was trying to get access to LIDAR data in Guatemala. I knew that this was going to be the path forward. And I wrote some grants with some people, and we were kind of striking out. And that's when you and I got connected by our mutual friend Jason, who said, you know, if it's so expensive, why don't I connect you with these engineers I know, and maybe you guys can engineer a solution. And so that's sort of what you and I started with, right? We were trying to develop drones that would be able to acquire LIDAR in the jungle, which it's funny to say that now, because as you know, time marches on and technology marches on, that's of course you know, very available, but it wasn't at the time, right?
Bear, let's pull up that photo of the Engineers for Exploration team, if you've got it. So what Tom's talking about here is probably as close as you can get to my origin story as a Nat Geo explorer. You know, I was in graduate school, and I read this article about Tom and his work and his colleagues and his mentors, and about this possibility that there was still a world of exploration out there. I think for a lot of us, we grow up and we start off as explorers in our hearts as little kids, thinking everything is new, everything's to be found. But then over time, you start getting told that it's all been figured out, that the age of exploration's in black and white photos. You fast forward, and all of a sudden, this moment, like LIDAR, shows up, and that changes it all again. But that first article that I read where you were using satellite imagery, that changed it for me. That really changed it for me. And I went out, and I started applying my engineering mindset to try to do something similar. I wanted to go find the tomb of Genghis Khan in Mongolia using satellites and drones and radar. And like you said, this was at a time when you couldn't buy a drone at 7-Eleven, right? Like, now you can, but yeah. You know, it's like,
yeah,
this was when they didn't exist. We didn't even know what to call them. We were calling them UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, and, you know, other things. And this wasn't that long ago. We're talking about 2010, 2008, 2009. So you fast forward a little bit more, and the success of that project kind of launched my career, the Mongolia project. And Jason Paterniti, who I didn't know at the time, actually had just been watching our careers sort of in the distance, and he said, let's link these two up.
Yeah.
So the next thing you know, Tom and I with Jason are romping through the jungles of Guatemala, and I'm just so out of my element. I mean, I've never been in a jungle before. And to, like, Guatemala is not a starter jungle, is it? I mean, this is like varsity level jungle, right?
Yeah. It was funny. What I remember about that is, you know, it was my first time working with engineers, and it was, you know, you had this great Engineers for Exploration, and it was you and your colleagues, Ryan Kastner and Kurt Schurgers, that had this great program to get engineers out of the lab into the field. And it was this really, I remember, rewarding collaboration, because I remember originally you guys hadn't been there and you wanted to bring a balloon. And I said,
we wanted to bring a blimp.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, there's no way. And I think you guys,
right,
had been there for about an hour, and you're like, yeah, there's no way we could have had a blimp here. But
can you pull up the photo of the Engineers for Exploration thing? So go on. I've got a good story about that, though.
Yeah, but when I remember from the collaboration, which went on for a few years beyond the initial trip, was, you know, I would kind of say, you know, well, it would be great if we could do X, and then your guys would be like, well, we can't exactly do that, but we could do Y and Z. And I could be like, well, Z doesn't really have any use for me, but let's focus on Y. And it was this great sort of back and forth between people from very different disciplines and different approaches to things that, even though we ended up not doing drone LIDAR, we did do a bunch of other stuff with LIDAR with your team. And it's still, you know, the lessons of collaborating with engineers as you've moved on into, you know, doing bigger and broader exploration things has sort of stuck with me, not only as specifically working with engineers, but being open to collaboration with all sorts of different fields.
Well, I'm touched that you say that. You know, now looking back some 10 years at our friendship, and really thinking about how it's changed both of our lives, you know, It's been awesome. You know, I've got these funny photos of our times in the jungles and how they've really, you know, they've shaped us. But really, more than anything else, I mean, I think it's been about shaping this idea that there is an age of discovery out there, right? You know, let's pull up that LIDAR image again that you had earlier, Bear. It's pretty wild to be able to see a landscape without the trees and realize that that might be as close as you can get to what it actually looked like in the time that the people who built those structures actually were there. So, okay, this is LIDAR. For our audience who may be coming to this after seeing Lost Cities or who may not be, let's break down LIDAR. How do you get an image like this out of what you don't realize in this image is that this is actually all super densely covered forest from above. How does this image appear, Tom?
Right. So, you know, the most common experience, you know, people would have from LIDAR would be if you've ever been in a car that beeps when it's about to hit something, right? That's a LIDAR sensor that's doing that because it's a laser that can take measurements. So you shoot a laser pulse, and when it hits a point of resistance, it's able to send back a three-dimensional coordinate. And so when you put a LIDAR sensor on a plane, you're basically scanning the ground below you as you fly the plane back and forth the same way that you would mow a lawn. And now we're talking about billions of laser pulses. And every time it hits a leaf or a branch or a Maya temple, it's going to send back a 3D coordinate. And we get billions of these measurements that make what's called a point cloud. And what we can do is we can feed all of that data, and we're talking, you know, terabytes of data into the computer and say, well, make me a model of the Earth that's only using the points that reach the ground. And what that does is it removes all of the points that touch the trees. I made that image. all the points that hit the trees, hit the branches, 92% of the data gets sort of put aside. And what we're left with is this model of the ground underneath. And it shows us the ancient landscape of the Maya.
So just walk us through exactly what is it that we're looking at on the image right now?
Yeah, so what I did here was the image on the left is sort of a before photo, right? And what that's using is something called GOI satellite imagery, which was collected by Digital Globe in 2009.
I was on their board for their foundation.
Yeah, yeah. And it was actually from your friends at the Waite Institute. They funded that satellite acquisition. Awesome. And so what I've done is I've basically taken the colors from the satellite imagery and assigned them to the pixels of all the LIDAR data. So you're getting a three-dimensional view of the forest. That's the left side. And then in the next image, I have just taken the points from the LIDAR that hit the ground, and you're looking at downtown El Zotes, the ancient Maya capital of a Maya city-state kingdom called Pak Khan, which means something like fortified sky, or more romantically, maybe a fortress in heaven, something like that. And these are the sorts of images that we started getting out of LIDAR data. And I can tell you, we mapped with ground instruments in this area for, you know, 6 or 7 years. And in a single day, this made a way more accurate and thorough map than anything that we had done.
El Zotes, the bat, right? Is that right? The bat.
Yeah.
So this is, for everybody out there, this is how Tom and I met and really spent our first couple of days together in the jungle, was at this location, El Zotes. And what you don't see here is, you know, the bats, of course. there's a lot of bats. There's a lot of, there's a lot of monkeys. There's a lot of snakes. The first thing Tom said to me is, everything's going to try to kill you. And he wasn't joking. Not everything was trying to kill me. There was the Fairdalance snake. Oh, yeah, this is our team from those early days. We called ourselves the Engineers for Exploration. There's Ryan Kastner and Kurt Strugers, and then a whole group of engineering students that we brought with us who had never been in the jungle before, and this made us all tougher for it. It was, there's little baby me over there.
Look how many legs you have.
I know. I had two legs back then.
Yeah.
I had two legs back then. I was still in the retro mode. I wasn't yet, you know, moving over to Albert 2.0. But we were that's an Azotes. And maybe we have Bear, do we have a video of the howler monkeys? I think I sent you a video just so you guys can get a sense of what it feels like to be in the jungle. Let's pull that up. Howler monkeys. While Bear's pulling that up, we'll explain who the howler monkeys are in a second. When you show up in the jungle, the first thing that hits you is the warmth. It's everywhere. The next thing that hits you is the noise. You know, it's just the sound, the cacophony of bugs and insects. The first time you spend the night in the jungle, you know, getting up to go pee in the middle of the night out of your tent is a confronting experience. First of all, you're completely afraid that something's going to jump out of the dark. But you turn on your flashlight, and there's a bajillion pairs of eyeballs staring back at you in every corner of the darkness. All these tiny little spiders and whatever else that, you know, what's out there? I have no idea. I remember one time you pull up your tent at the end of the season and there's huge tarantulas that you've crushed in the night, right? What are some of the weirdest things you've seen at camp?
Well, there was one of the larger guys on our team, we rolled up his tent at the end of the season, and there was a flat frog under there, which that was, but yeah, you know, all sorts of things come out. And it's interesting because when you have been in the jungle for a while, you realize there's real marked seasonalities to bugs. So, you know, they sort of come in sequence in these swarms that come out, and then, you know, this beetle comes out and then it's gone, and then the termites come out and then they're gone. And you know, once the rains really start, there are these toads. They're called the woe toads, and they end up, you know, being thousands and thousands of them, and they're just croaking all the time. And it that's when you know it's sort of time to go. Like the rain's going to be too much.
The woe toads. Okay, here's a video that I just sent Bear of the sound of one of the most impressive sounds of the jungle. Let's play it real quick. Can we hear it?
It's monkeys.
Oh, look at those cuties. Those are the howler monkeys. Okay, I know that a lot of you have been to the jungle and probably heard the sound of the howler monkey before, but for those who haven't, the first time you hear a howler monkey coming through the jungle, you look back and you expect to see T-Rex. It's not some subtle thing. It's a call, right? What did you're saying at the beginning of this call before we started recording? What did the Maya call the howler monkeys?
Yeah, well, you know, my good colleague Steve Houston is, you know, one of the leading people that interprets sort of Maya religion and art and writing. The way that he described it was as the herald of the dawn, and it's what lets the ancient Maya world know that, you know, time and the cosmos is going to continue, that the sun has survived its evening battle through the underworld and is going to emerge again. So it's that early morning sound. It's true in the jungle, you know, maybe you're getting the first glimmers of light in your tent. It's starting to get a little lighter, and then you hear the and, you know, that's like, okay, I guess it's time to get up and start the day, right?
I mean, you went silent. It's more like a, right? It's like a, I mean, it's everywhere.
Yeah, I remember once in grad school, I had to, you know, take a break from work to go, you know, take care of some business. And so I wandered off a little bit off trail into the jungle. I'm in the most compromising position I can be in, I just hear, it sounded like the Jabba the Hutt catching, you know, Princess Leia trying to rescue Han Solo. It's just this like, because they take a little while to warm up, and I look up and they're all above me, and you know, there's nothing I can do.
Yeah. Oh man, man, you did your business under the howls of the rising sun, huh?
Better.
I mean, I don't know. That's kind of like, that's asking for trouble from the cosmos.
You know, if you look at the cover of the book that I did with Steve Houston, Temple of the Night Sun, maybe we could get an image of that book cover.
Let's see if we can pull it up there.
It has a spectacular profile of this pot that we found in a royal tomb, and it is the profile of the howler monkey calling out, and it's got its tongue flapping out, and it's exactly what we're talking about.
You said it's the Temple of the Night Sun. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
It's the Temple of the Night Sun. That's a cool title for a book. Just so you guys know, Steve Houston, he was your professor, right? He was your mentor, or was he one of your colleagues that was of your mentor?
Yeah, so I had a postdoctoral fellowship with Steve Houston. So that's the news story about it, but there should be a book cover.
Let's see. Maybe there's a book cover. But you know what's so cool is that this pot that you're talking about was something that you excavated, right?
Yeah, there it is. There we go. So that is a Maya representation of a howler monkey calling out in the morning.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so let's bring the Maya into context. Give me a timeline. When did they begin? When did their empire max and peak out? And then you know, what's the long tail story? Because they're still around today, actually. That's something that I think is a misconception from a lot of us in the world, is that the Maya are gone. Yet they are not. They're still very much alive, as I just experienced, in Chiapas. But can you give us, in the most broad terms, what we're staring at when we think about the Maya overall?
Sure. When people are traditionally thinking about the ancient Maya, they're thinking about what we call the classic Maya, which goes from about 250 to 900 CE. Okay.
By CE, what do you mean by CE? Just
common era, or we could also say AD, if that's easier. You know, people have different opinions about which.
Sure, of course.
Which way?
I'm just trying to. CD. So, just to over-explain everything. So C.
Yeah, yeah. 250 to 900 in the common era, the current era we live in, and so that's the classic period, and that's the time of the great Maya kingdoms. They were never an empire, which is what distinguishes them from, say, the Aztec and Inca, who are probably the other two major cultures people are familiar with in the Americas. They're a city-state culture like the Greeks. So there's individual kingdoms with individual dynasties, and sometimes they would band together and form alliances, or one would become sort of subsumed under the other. But in general, each had its own ruler, you know? And so that's what people think of when they're generally thinking about the Maya. But there's a whole period before them, the pre-classic Maya, that begins at about 1000 BC. And then there's a whole period after that, which is the post-classic Maya, which goes up to the time of Spanish contact. And then the Maya then continue to exist in one form or another, up into the present and the modern descendant communities that are very much involved in how we study the ancient Maya today. And so, if we put 1000 BC as the approximate start time of ancient Maya civilization, we're talking about over 3,000 years of a cultural tradition. And it has certainly, of course, over that amount of time and space that it covers, has lots of ups and downs and transformations and transitions. But, what fascinates archaeologists about the Maya is that they have their own writing system. And so their hieroglyphs have been deciphered, and we now have history in their own words telling the stories of these kingdoms and their rises and falls and their conflicts with one another and their interactions with not just other Maya kingdoms, but with other civilizations that were existing in central Mexico at the time. And so it's a really exciting time where, you know, we can think of this in the same way we think about European history and the history of kingdoms and conflicts and like the medieval period. That's how we should be thinking about it. These are a people with their own history and their own story to tell.
Can you pull back to that that timeline? I don't know. Actually, we probably should also show where we got this timeline. We're just doing a web search here, so I don't know the source for that. But if we go back to the timeline. Do you know the source of this, Bear? I don't know. We'll throw that out on post. But this
you should
shows,
get a better one. That one's wrong.
What's the right one?
I don't know, but 2500's way too early.
Okay, so 2500's too early. This is a timeline that we just pulled up from the internet. Where do you think it really sort of originates? Where is, for example, the recent discovery by your colleague, what's his name?
Takeshi Inomata, University of Arizona, you know, 1100, 1000, that's sort of where we're getting to with 1100, 1000 BC. Or BCE, that's really what we're talking about.
Okay.
Because before that, we have the great Olmec culture, which overlapped with the pre-classic Maya and interacted with them.
Okay, so what you just described to me is this arc, right? There was a kind of a rise and fall in between, but there was a catalyzing moment somewhere in the early days, maybe around 1000 BC. You know, we're talking before Alexander the Great. We're talking about before the pyramids of Egypt were built. We're talking about, you know, like very, 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 what?
No, I mean, not that far back. Yeah, the pyramids are still older than...
Okay, before Alexander the Great,
before
the Roman Empire, before the Terracotta Warriors were, you know, buried underneath the first emperor of China... There was the beginnings of the Maya. And what I've always been really struck by was, you know, is how humanity emerges and exists in different places, you know, in different climates, because these are all different versions of us. I always think of these different civilizations as part of my own DNA. No matter where I'm from, they're all within me because I'm a part of the human experience. And I'm looking at these as versions of what I could have experienced, right? So for the Maya, it's the jungle. And what you're really pioneering with the LIDAR is being able to remove this thing that they, you know, digitally, that occludes or hides what their world was. But when they were there, their world wasn't what I think we all think it, you know, when we go and walk around a Maya site, you see ruins. What was the Maya world like when they were thriving? What would the buildings have looked like? Would there have been jungle everywhere? Would it have been mowed lawns? Like what? Put me in the context of a living Maya. What does my daily life look like?
Yeah. You know, so if you were, you know, a Maya farmer, which is probably what most people were, you know, and you had your maize field and grew your beans and your squash and supported your family, you were probably, especially if you were located in sort of the central part of the Maya area, a citizen, for lack of a better word, of a kingdom. And there would have been a ruling family and a whole sort of structure of social hierarchy that you would have, you know, paid tribute to. You would have helped support that kingdom. Maybe you would be called on to fight occasionally for them. But your day-to-day, year-to-year life would be focused on the agricultural cycle and, you know, dedication to your fields. Now, if you were maybe like a merchant or someone, you know, of a little bit higher standing, well, then you might live in the center of the city. And these would have been large areas covered with brilliant white plaster plazas, the structures of pyramids and royal palaces, all would have been covered with plaster. Many of them would have been painted or, you know, decorated with large masks of different gods and people.
What colors were they painted?
So the strongest color palettes, especially for, you know, painting large surfaces, first there would have been a sort of deep red that would have been over a lot of areas, and it was a very easy pigment to make with cinnabar. Then black is also a very strong one. But then we also get yellows. And then in the classic period, the Maya actually created what we call Maya blue, which took a very long time for us to figure out how they were actually able to synthesize a blue pigment with what was available. And I don't, off the top of my head, remember the answer to it, but some chemists did figure it out. And they also had, you know, whites and things like that. And we know this from, you know, excavating buried structures. And by buried structures, I don't mean like we take the jungle off and then that's what's there. Those ruins are usually just the sort of gray limestone that you see in a reconstructed Maya site. But as archaeologists, we tunnel into these buildings, and as you tunnel, you're tunneling back in time also, right? And so buried underneath the buildings that are ruined on the surface by the jungle are the preserved structures of earlier versions of that city. And that's where we start to see, you know, incredible buildings decorated with masks of Maya gods and painted in all these brilliant colors, or, you know, in some cases, incredible, you know, polychrome murals covering multiple rooms. So,
okay, so this is how I first met you, right? We were rolling into the jungle, and it was hot and muggy and nasty. And we land in your site of El Zotes, where you were director of archaeology there at the time. And then we walk a little ways up the path that you could see in that LiDAR data, and all of a sudden we show up at this pyramid that you were excavating. I forget which one it was. I think it was maybe at El Diablo. It was a hell of a hike to get there, and I remember getting up to the top of this mountain, and we enter into this small tunnel that was being, you know, there was a bunch of people moving material out, you know, any bits of debris that were being dug out in this kind of chain of people moving material out. And we crawl in down through the heart of this pyramid. And what you explained to me was that a Maya pyramid is like an onion. On the outside, you have the latest layer, and then you have layers and layers and layers and layers and layers all the way down. And that at the base level is where all the tombs would have been. Right. But when you get, as you're going in, you're like going through time, like rings of a tree. And I remember showing up to, which I don't know which temple that is, but as we went further and further and further in, Bear, I'm going to send you some images of what was on the inside of this for putting up afterwards. But we got to a mask of the sun god that was. Yeah, there it is. Was incredible. But he had his nose punched in. And you explained to me that when they built the new pyramid on top of it, they had to actively destroy the mask to deactivate the god there. Is that right?
Yeah. So the mask we're looking at the screen, this particular temple that you're talking about, which we called the Temple of the Night Sun, is covered by all sorts of different deity masks. And so this particular one we're looking at is a sort of fusion of the nighttime sun when it's going through the underworld and the sun at dawn at its time of emergence. And you can see that there's a little sort of triangle shark tooth in its mouth, And above that, the mask is kind of destroyed. And that's where the nose of this god would have been. And like you're saying, it's been deliberately chipped away. And that's because, I guess for lack of a better word, Maya's soul or essence was held in your breath. And these gods that they created on their architecture were considered to be living images of that deity. And so if you were going to replace it and bury it and build a new temple, you had to release that essence. And so they would chip away the breathing apparatus of the god to sort of release that essence out of it.
Now, this is getting into the Maya belief system, which is always so interesting to me. You know, right now we're looking at the top of these pyramids. I think that looks like Tikal. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, that hilltop we were on, if you looked over to the east, you could see these pyramids in the very distance popping up over the jungle canopy like that, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And that must be early morning with the fog rising across the peaks of Tikal. Now, Tikal is, I would say, one of the most incredible places I've been. And for the Maya, as far as I understand it, it represents the center of one of the biggest kingdoms of the Maya world. Is that right?
Exactly. You know, when we're talking about, you know, the heyday, the classic period of the Maya, particularly, you know, at the beginning of that period, Tikal really emerges as the biggest player amongst all these city-state kingdoms.
So who are the other ones?
I mean, there are literally dozens of them, but, you know, the big rival to Tikal we refer to as the Snake Kingdom, which was first at a site called Sibanche in Mexico, and then, or in Quintana Roo state in Mexico, and then they moved their kingdom to a place called Calakmul in Campeche in Mexico. And Palenque would have been another capital of a Maya kingdom, very famous site in Chiapas. We have river kingdoms like Piedras Negras and Yaxchilan. In the far southeast in Honduras, we have Copan, which is kind of the gateway to the rest of Central America and the resources from there. And the kingdom where, you know, we first had the success with LIDAR with Arlen and Diane Chase, Caracol in Belize. So those are just some of the big ones and the most famous ones. But there are, you know, dozens of them. And we know it because each one had its own specific glyphic title for the dynasty.
Yeah, that's what's wild, is that this city-state where there's lots of little cities emerging in the jungle, they shared a somewhat common written language, right? They emerged in the early days as families, and then those families developed what would you describe, like a hierarchy, a social hierarchy over time. And then the next thing you know, you end up with bigger and bigger cities and kings and peasants and everything in between. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's definitely this system of divine dynastic kingship where, you know, in general, rule was passed from father to son, but not always. Particularly in times of turmoil, we get the occasional, you know, Maya queen as a sort of absolute ruler, or, you know, sometimes it passes to a brother, but they try to keep it in the family, and they're all using this same very complex written hieroglyphic script that my colleagues have determined is reflecting an almost formal courtly language, you know, sort of the way that Latin works for the Catholic Church. It's, you know, probably not the way people are speaking in their day-to-day interactions, but it's a very, you know, formalized written expression that's shared amongst these courts.
Now, I've never been able, as hard as you've tried, and as, you know, even Dave Stewart tried to explain how to interpret a glyph to me once. Dave Stewart is the probably one of the foremost people credited with deciphering the Maya glyphs. I have never been able to figure out how to make sense of any of this. You know, the glyphs are just so enigmatic to me, and I can't imagine that it would have been easy to learn this and that it would be commonly used. Who amongst the Maya really used this written language? Was it for everybody, or was it just the elite?
No, yeah, it's certainly an elite script, and it's extremely complicated, as you say. It's almost deliberately complicated. The way that different scribes would sort of play around with different glyphs to sort of come up with a new representation of a sign that still held the original meaning, it's almost like they're challenging other people that know the script to see if they know how to read it. And so, you know, this is why it, you know, takes over 150 years to decipher Maya writing, because it is one of the most complex scripts to ever be developed. And it's a combination of glyphs that have the meaning of a whole word, you know, one sign equals one word, versus other signs that represent sounds or syllables. Mm. And so there are lots of different ways that you could spell things out depending on which combination of signs you want to use.
What can we go back one, Bear, to the other image before? I think that other image was the Dresden Codex. Was that right?
Yes.
Let's go back to the Dresden Codex. Okay, this is a cool one. It gets the name Dresden for where it was refound, right? It was found in the war or post-war era in, I don't know, some bunker or some basement in Dresden. But it...
Yeah.
Was it a library? Okay.
Yeah.
But it represents one of, I don't know, how many of these codexes that still remains? How many are there, Tom? I think most of them got destroyed, right?
Yeah, there's four surviving Maya books. They're all very late. They're all from the post-classic period. The Dresden Codex that we're looking at is hypothesized to be copied from an earlier document, and so it's generally considered to be, you know, maybe the oldest of these, but still a very late document. But we know from images on Maya pots and things like that that these bark paper books that sort of open like these accordion screens were a part of everyday life. And so the texts for the ancient Maya that we read and that have been deciphered come from carvings in their stone monuments, paintings on their pots. Those are the two sort of most common sources. But, you know, we get them incised on jade objects, occasionally painted on murals. But, you know, we have to think that there were also, you know, these books all over these kingdoms that held all sorts of other types of knowledge and things that are lost.
What happened to them all?
Well, you know, the classic period ones, who knows? Occasionally in a tomb, there will be a mushy pile of something in a corner, and people will say, I bet this was a codice. But then the ones that date to the time of the Dresden Codex and the other three surviving books, those are ones that were being sort of kept in communities up in Yucatan. And Spanish friar Diego de Landa, was trying to stamp out what he considered to be idolatry being practiced amongst the Maya in Yucatan, got together all of the books that he could collect from these different places all over the Yucatan Peninsula and burned them in what's called his auto de fe. And
when was that again? That was
this would be mid 1500s. I think 1542 is my guess, but don't hold me to it. So he does this, and this was actually even a little bit extreme for other people in Yucatan, and he gets sent back to Spain to sort of defend his actions. And it's during this time where he's awaiting, you know, having to account for what he's done, that he writes this book called the Relación de las Cosas de Yucatán. It's basically the relation or the telling of all things about Yucatán. And actually, there's a excellent new translation that just came out this year of that. But it's where we get a lot of our firsthand knowledge of what the Maya were like in the immediate decades after contact with the Spanish. And importantly, he's got a page in there that we refer to as Landa's alphabet. He couldn't conceive of a Maya writing system that wasn't alphabetic like his. And so he's just drawing these signs where he's making, some poor informant say, what they mean. He's like, well, what letter's this? What letter's this? What letter's this? And of course, there aren't letters at all. There are these sounds, but it ends up being the key to how eventually epigraphers unlocked understanding all of Maya, ancient Maya writing. And so Landa's this very complicated figure where, he is reviled for this destruction of knowledge. But then in the end, he sort of provided the Rosetta Stone that was necessary to decipher Maya hieroglyphs.
I mean, there's a lot of irony in there, right? He destroys the very thing that, that he inadvertently, unknowingly facilitated the deciphering of. And yet there's still a few that remain. I mean, I've heard about this moment where all the Maya knowledge and wisdom in the codices that were burned disappeared. And I think there's a quote somewhere where even one of his, one of his fellow priests said that they could feel the heat of hell in the actions of what they were doing, showing that they probably knew that this was awful to destroy that knowledge, right?
But going
back to the codice, the Dresden Codex. I mean, the fact that that was found in World War II, is that right? Somewhere around there?
No. The codices were all found in the sort of 19th century. And that's, it was European librarians working with these sorts of volumes that first helped us understand the Maya calendar and the number system and things like that.
Let's pull up the Dresden Codex, because I think there was what's that?
The event that you're referring to in World War II is during the bombing of Dresden, a Soviet soldier, Yuri Konorosov, went in and found I think it was the bombing of Dresden. I know that the original Dresden Codex was damaged during the bombing of Dresden, but Yuri Konorosov was in World War II, and he was in a bombed out European city, and he found a book that had lithographs of the known Maya books. So they weren't the original ones. And he took that with him back to the Soviet Union. And he was a linguist. And he's the one that made the connection between Diego de Landa's alphabet and starting to figure out that these were sounds and making some decipherments that provided the basic methodology that would eventually lead later scholars to more completely decipher the Maya script. And so that was the sort of World War II event that happened. It was this key scholar, finding this copy in this bombed out building and then taking it back and using it.
Okay, well, you fast forward a little bit, let's keep this image on, but you fast forward a little bit and the deciphering of these strange squiggles and circles and pictures that don't really look like pictures, it becomes possible. And what are we looking at in these six pages, these six panels? What is this?
Yeah, so, again, these are very late. And what's interesting about the codices is that they're showing us a type of knowledge the Maya are recording that we don't really see on carved monuments and stuff like that. And so you're getting these red and black symbols that are made up of combinations of bars and dots. And these are numbers. A dot is one, a bar is five. So three red dots over one red bar is the number eight. Two black dots over three black bars is the number 17. And what people were able to work out is that they are counting days with these, and they're using it to track all sorts of things, phases of the moon, phases of Venus, and they're actually, in the images we're looking at here, able to predict eclipses. And so...
Oh, you know I love eclipses. I'm always talking about eclipses.
Yeah, the Maya were famed astronomers. They had a better understanding of the phases of the moon and the cycles of Venus than the Europeans who came in and conquered the Aztecs and the Maya. They were that good, and all through naked eye astronomy.
Okay, I've got a thing for solar or just anything astronomical, you know, as an experience. I grew up the son of an astrophysicist, right? So my childhood was spent looking at the stars, and, you know, I never really have seen a total eclipse, but there's one coming in a couple of weeks, right? There's a total solar eclipse that's path of totality is passing from New York down through Texas, where you are, and then down into Mazatlan, which unfortunately doesn't have any of the Maya activity that, you know, would have been represented here in this image, right? But from this perspective, what you're showing me, I think what you said to me earlier a couple of weeks ago when I was asking about Maya, you know, eclipses, was that those black and white sort of square objects, oh, this is the one coming April 8th? Okay, so we're pulling up April 8th. Is there anything in here that's Maya, and anything in the path of totality that might be
No, this is, you know, this is on the very edge of, you know, the, what we'd even call Mesoamerica. So, yeah, there's no...
Temple to the...
Definitely nothing, Maya.
Man. I'm going to go somewhere April 8th. Where would you go if you were a Mayanist or an or any kind of Mesoamerican researcher to experience a timeless journey through the cosmos?
I would come here to Austin, Texas, where we have 12 people who study the ancient Maya at UT in all sorts of different departments. But yeah.
But I want to feel what it feels like to see a total eclipse on a pyramid. Going back to that Dresden Codex, what is the symbol for the eclipse? It's that black image and the white image, right? How did the Maya? Yeah. How did they relate to the cosmos through either their relationship to the sun, the seasons, or the eclipses? Like, what were all these things to them?
Yeah, they're showing the duality of lightness and darkness, basically, right? And so this is a fundamental principle of not just Maya, but all Mesoamerican religion, the same one shared by the Aztecs, where, you know, there's two halves to everything and you need them both to make a whole. So male, female, hot, cold, day, night, heavens, underworld, left, right. And so anything that brings to bear natural occurrences of that duality is going to be sacred. And so, you know, this image that we have up here, the little central disc that's in the middle of the black and white wings, that's the Maya word for the sun, but also it's the same word they use for a day, keen. And so it's dangling from what's called a sky band, basically a representation of the heavens, and that is an eclipse. And you know, don't ask me about what the serpent's doing, but you know, serpents were considered to be these sort of connectors between the heavens and the earthly realm.
Wow, so the duality of existence is at the center of even the Maya language. Is that what you just described?
Maya religion and creation. You know, it's their understanding of the universe around you. You know, you need to have these two sides to make a whole. But they love to divide things. You also need to have four quarters and a center. You know, the cardinal directions and then the fifth direction at the center. All of these are sort of fundamental concepts of how the Maya rationalized and understood the physical world around them. And it's a very different way of thinking than we have in the West. And, you know, it's one of the things I like to teach my students is, you know, we know so much about this culture from their own art and writing that it is possible to consider the world from the perspective of how the ancient Maya would have considered the world. And forcing yourself to do that, you know, helps you with other things, like realizing that, you know, when we're talking to people, it's so easy to talk past people because we're not considering that they're coming from a totally different worldview. And so, you know, in your podcast, Ancient Echoes, these are the echoes of the past that come forward to us and help us to, you know, help to relate with what's going on in the present and how we communicate with each other.
How are you are united? You know, the yeah, well, look, I mean, one of the favorite dualities that I learned of the Maya language was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think love is paired with pain. Is that right?
I don't know that one. Yeah.
Oh, because that'd be true. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. I don't know. Maybe that's what it was. Okay. So getting into the, why wouldn't you just go and turn and talk to a living descendant of the Maya to try to understand the Maya cosmovision or the Maya ancient beliefs? Is it because the knowledge was cut off at some point, or, you know, like why not just, because there are still Maya that live all over the ancient Maya world, but today, right?
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, we do work with modern Maya communities and scholars, and you know, the Maya are very active. The modern Maya are very active in helping to understand the ancient Maya, and the modern perspective is invaluable because it does draw on this long tradition of these deep-held beliefs about, you know, the structure of the world and, you know, the understanding of creation. It's also been transformed over hundreds of years, including, you know, the violent interaction of European intervention that, you know, caused the death and reorganization of so many communities. And so we have to remember that all of that plays into where the modern beliefs are now. In the same way that, you know, my perspective of the world, if I were to talk to one of my ancestors in, you know, AD 500 England somewhere, would probably have a very different view of the world and cosmos than I do today. So,
but the Maya, they collapsed before this, well, the classic Maya period collapsed before the Spanish arrived, right? And so if one theory that's been tossed around that you've told me about as well, I'm not sure if you told me or somebody else told me, but it was that when somewhere around maybe it was 700 CE/AD, there was a series of mega wars. I might not be getting the date right, but these what have been referred to as Star Wars. We did a show on this once where I was able to spend time with our friend Francisco and others over in the world of the Snake Kings. And there were these mega battles between the worlds of Tikal and the worlds of the Snakes and Palenque and others, and that everything kind of just went silent for a long time. And in that period, I was informed that there was one theory that when everything kind of fell down, there was a revolt, potentially, where the elite were sort of wiped out, and those who knew how to read the language and keep a lot of the library of information that had been built in those languages had been eradicated. Do you subscribe to that theory?
Well, you know, when we talk about the so-called Maya collapse, right? You know, we are talking about the end of this system of divine kingship more than anything else. Because as you've noted and as we've talked about, you know, obviously there are millions of descendants of Maya culture today. And, you know, the specific events you're talking about, you know, the sort of total war situation that existed in the Western Maya area, that's just one thing that's happening at the time. And, you know, warfare was existing before that. We're seeing it at the start of Maya civilization also. You and I went up to the fortress at La Cuernavilla, which is very, very early. So I think what we're dealing with...
Let's pull that back. We were the first ever there in La Cuernavilla, right? Before, since the time of the Maya. Weren't we the first ones to stumble across that?
I mean, I was. You were there in with Steve Houston in 2017, right? Yeah. But
this is what's remarkable about the moment that we're in. Just LIDAR is making it possible to see things and make discoveries at sites that nobody knew about since the collapse of the classic period Maya, right? I mean, being able to be, you know, a top-down viewer of the Maya in the landscape through all these different layers of time, never was possible at this scale before, you know, the last decade, right? Before the last 10 years. So right, what is this moment as an archaeologist? What does this feel like? It's got to feel like, I mean, this is not just some small, you know, isolated discovery. This is a systematic watershed moment for the investigation of the whole Maya world.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to have to take a pause a sec because I got to go soon. So do you want me to finish the collapse bit or do you want me to answer that bit?
I think maybe that bit's more interesting. I mean, the collapse, everybody thinks about the Maya collapse, right? Like the collapse is happening, you know, for many different reasons. Who knows? And it kind of happens in different phases. But what being able to go and spend time now with you and other Mayanists that are out there and being able to be sometimes the first person across a new pyramid or a new city or a new, you know, building, even just even holding a piece of pottery that hasn't been held for 1,000 years before is not something I thought would be a part of my daily experience. But what is this moment it is now, right? Like all of a sudden there's new discoveries every single year that are of a scale that I didn't know was possible. The first year that we went out with LIDAR, that you got through the Pakunam LIDAR initiative with the consortium of archaeologists, how many new discoveries were made?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that first phase of that was over 2,000 square kilometers of LIDAR over a totally forested area in northern Guatemala, the Maya Biosphere Reserve. And I think there were 7 or 8 archaeological projects working in different areas there. And in each one, you know, we're talking about thousands of new structures, dozens of new sites. And so it's really exciting because the Maya writing system that we've talked about really only is kind of fully deciphered to the point where we're comfortable that we basically know what's being said. In the 90s, you know, there was a lot leading up to that where sort of structure of the language, but where we're really getting into these history of Maya kingdoms is sort of the mid-90s moving forward. And so now what we have is this technology that's letting us see the landscape where this history played out. And, you know, unlike, say, the history of the Roman Empire, where we have great detail about what went on, but it's all buried under modern Europe. We have preserved under the forests, you know, the footprint of this ancient civilization. And so it's a really exciting time where, you know, it's not just about knowing what the big kingdoms are, but, you know, can we track down some of these little places that are, you know, mentioned here and there? And Can we figure out, you know, okay, we know there was a great battle between these places. Well, now we can literally see the extent of the military engineering. You know, this isn't just
the Tikal Wall. You know, like things like that. I was with Steve Housen that first year with the LIDAR, and we were able to sort of see that there was a wall from above that you wouldn't be able to see on the ground. When you're hiking across this jungle, the small details that you see in the image here are not visible. So all of a sudden with this, you can see it's all there, but it's the small, like you said, it's the small stuff, right? When we looked at, I don't know where the image exists anymore, but there was a place where you could see fields that were irrigated, you know, in large scales. And that you would not have any clue about from the ground floor when you're standing there. But from above, you get a sense that there was large-scale agriculture, which talks about, you know, how do we think about the population of the Maya in a different way? So in this last couple of years, what's fundamentally changed? Has the population estimates changed? What else has changed in terms of the belief of what the Maya world was from the academic point of view?
Well, I think, you know, there's nothing we found in LIDAR that we didn't, like, know existed as a thing they did before. So, like, we knew that they had some walls. We knew that they had some roads. We knew that they had some fields. We knew, you know, that there was settlement. But what LIDAR did was, one, it just amplified. It'd be like, oh, they didn't just have a few walls. Like, we're talking about kilometers and kilometers of walls. And, you know, they didn't just have a handful of roads. There's whole networks of interconnected sites in some areas. And, you know, there aren't just a few places where they were experimenting with wetland agriculture. There's, you know, dozens of square kilometers of field systems now. And we're seeing how it all fits together. And we're seeing that it's not uniform across this, you know, huge area. So, you know, density changes depending on where you are, and the type of agricultural technology changes depending on where you are. My colleagues here in the Department of Geography at University of Texas, Tim Beach and Cheryl Lazader Beach, they're the ones that have been working in Belize with the clearest field system that we were looking at a little bit earlier in one of the images, where, you know, they're finding remnants of digging sticks in some of these field systems and stuff like that, wooden digging sticks that are preserved by waterlogged things. And so we're seeing how everything came together and articulated and functioned, and it's giving us this more holistic, complete understanding of an ancient society that's really not accessible in a lot of areas of the world because of modern development. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why the preservation of the forests in northern Guatemala has been so important, because this isn't, you know, totally deforested and has, you know, all sorts of new modern settlement in there, which has happened in some areas in Belize and Mexico where we have LIDAR. But here, you know, we have this kind of pristine ancient footprint of the impact of an ancient culture, and that's what's really unique.
I mean, it's a time capsule. It's literally a time capsule. And, you know, I know you have to go soon, but I've had the great honor of being able to jump into a bunch of different archaeological sites across the Maya world and beyond. And what I've seen is that this still exists in the footprint and the mindset and the spirit of the people that are the descendants of the Maya, right? Like in the jungles of Chiapas, I spent time recently with the Lacandon, and they describe everything as having a soul. You know, like the tree had a soul, a rock had a soul. The water underneath the surface of the lake was the primordial water where the souls came from. And there was this relationship to nature that was really remarkable, that I feel like in some ways we've lost. I wondered if we could end with one last bit of knowledge around, you once described to me the Maya relationship to energy, that I think is as close as you can get to a tangent of modern spirituality, you know, in California as you can get, right? But can you tell me, can you describe to everybody what is this energy force of the ancient Maya that might still sort of persist in the mindset and spirit of the living Maya?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and this comes from some very perceptive glyphic decipherments by my colleagues Steve Houston and Dave Stewart in the 1990s. But there's lots of different essences. So you mentioned, you know, the souls of things, the chulel in the language of sort of modern people in Chiapas. That's one type of force. But for the classic Maya, there's this ku. It's with a hard K, like a ku. And this is this sort of holy essence that it's like a godly sacred force that flows through things. And so, you know, Maya kings are called kul ahau. Ahau is the word for lords. And kul basically means like holy or sacred, because it's filled with this sacred essence. And so that is what sort of permeates everything, you know, almost in a, you know, Star Wars-like description, right? The force, right? It's running through everything living around us. The religion is animistic, right? Just as the Lacandon you got to spend time with are saying, you know, everything's got some sort of spirit or essence to it. And yeah, that is something that pervades the Maya perspective of the universe and the physical world around them. And, you know, these different essences and forces also exist in a sort of other world. Like when we're sleeping, we have a spirit that is our sort of counterpart that exists. So it's very much, a vision of the world, like you said, that is not familiar to people raised in sort of Western U.S. culture, but I think one that resonates and makes sense if you have the privilege to spend time in these places that are so full of life.
Yeah, full of life. Like you said, you know, the first time we met in the jungle, I was just taken aback by the amount of life. I just want to say thank you. I hope this is the first of several moments where we can chat, Tom, because I don't think we just scratched the surface there.
All right, man. Thank you.